I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CBS This Morning podcast. I'm Bianca Goladriga. Last week, I spoke with New York Times columnist and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicholas Kristof. We discussed the North Korea threat and the opioid crisis in America. He recently returned from an assignment in North Korea where he learned North Korea's perspective on the United States.
There was an undertone from officials to ordinary people that war is coming, that indeed nuclear exchanges are coming, and that we are prepared for it, we will accept it, and we will not only survive this war, we will win, we will defeat you.
To the president's credit, this is something he inherited. It's a crisis
Absolutely.
That he walked into. It's something that President Obama pulled him aside in their meeting and said, this is what you're going to be dealing with, and this is what you probably are going to be facing the toughest decisions and choices about. It's something administrations, both Republican and Democratic, have been dealing with for years going into the Trump administration. President Trump, being bombastic as he is, said that he's going to be the one who's going to fix it. What is your take on the rhetoric alone, not the policy, but the rhetoric that has been coming out of this president with regards to North Korea?
So I think that President Trump's intention is to intimidate the North Koreans and get them to back down, put extra pressure on them. In fact, as he was warned, I think it has been counterproductive, especially to make it personal about Kim Jong-un. And it was striking to me when I was in North Korea, that ordinary people didn't know anything about, for example, Otto Warmbier, the young University of Virginia student who died after being detained there. But they knew all about President Trump's rhetoric about North Korea, and that's because it fits into the Kim Jong-un narrative that the United States is always bullying North Korea, that it's threatening North Korea, and that Kim Jong-un is the savior who will use his nuclear weapons, his nuclear deterrent, to protect the Korean people from those American imperialist aggressors. And I think that personalizing the dispute has also made it harder to find exit ramps that that might find some kind of a deal to make this problem go away.
Let's go back to your most recent trip. You said that you were screened up and down, that they went through your phone to look at your photos and your computer, and once you arrived, they put you in a hotel outside of the city, which is not typically what you would have done in previous trips. You stayed in Pyongyang. This time you were on the outskirts. And it was interesting because you said you thought it was done for self-protection. They were looking to protect you.
That's right. They were, you know, at first I thought, oh, this is just the North Koreans, you know, trying to isolate me from ordinary people, impede my reporting, protect the North Korean people from my vigorous New York Times questioning. But no, it turns out that it wasn't that at all. It was essentially there to protect me from the security forces and the military who might be against the idea of my visit and who, if I did something wrong, might grab me and then the foreign ministry might not be able to extricate me. And that was kind of nerve-wracking to think that they were worried about my safety.
All of the saber rattling you hear, and you describe it as being part of their everyday life. The people in North Korea, they go to a dolphin show, and there are images of missiles. Right, television shows, you see missiles.
Even flying into the country, you know, the in-flight entertainment on Air Koryo, the North Korean airline, it was this military orchestra playing beautiful classical music, and then interspersed with these scenes, these clips of missiles firing off. It was really kind of eerie.
So, but talking to the people on the ground there, and obviously I would imagine you were only speaking to people you were allowed to speak with, were they prepared for war? I mean, do they want to fight the U.S.?
Look, I don't think anybody wants war. And they would periodically, when pushed, they would say, oh, you know, we don't want a war. It's you guys who want the war. But there was an undertone from officials to ordinary people that war is coming, that indeed nuclear exchanges are coming, and that we are prepared for it, we will accept it, and we will not only survive this war, we will win, we will defeat you, and you Americans will be forced out of Asia. The world will celebrate Kim Jong-un as the great new leader. He will unify the Korean Peninsula. It was bizarre, and you don't know whether Kim Jong-un actually believes his own propaganda, but boy, you sure hope he doesn't.
What are the people on the ground, and what is Kim Jong-un? We've seen the statements that he's made publicly calling President Trump a dotard. What do they think of Donald Trump?
People have been steeped in anti-American rhetoric all their lives. It's part of the education system and the school books. It's part of their 2 hours of political study every day. And their narrative is that the U.S. Moved in after World War II to divide the Korean Peninsula and dismember the Korean nation, then attacked North Korea because it was the authentic spokesman of the Korean people, and repeatedly has been trying to attack North Korea, and that each time the North Koreans have outmaneuvered or defeated the U.S. And so when that's the only narrative you know, then, you know, brainwashing can work. I was struck that I was asking several of the military people we talked to when they talked about how the U.S. had started the Korean War, which is completely preposterous. We know that, in fact, it was the North that started it. But I was asking them, so if you claim that the U.S. started it by invading to the North, then how is it that North Korea managed to advance south within 3 days and grab Seoul? And they were kind of deer in the headlights. They'd never really thought of it because they only have their one narrative.
Who do they hate more or see as more of a rival or enemy, South Korea or the U.S.?
The U.S., although Japan is certainly Japan is the is kind of the number one enemy for historic reasons, because Japan had occupied the Korean Peninsula, and a lot of the nationalism that is really Kim Jong-un's glue and legitimacy is based on standing up to the Japanese. The U.S., I think people have complicated feelings about. I think they would like a peace treaty with the U.S. I think they think the U.S. is the most powerful country, and they would like to figure out some way of having better relations. Well, the official narrative is that South Korea is just a pawn of the U.S., controlled by the U.S. That's been harder for them to claim, since now South Korea is democratic, it's so economically prosperous. In the past, the people had always insisted that North Korea was richer than South Korea. And this time I asked some young people, so which is richer, North Korea or South Korea? And they froze and they couldn't answer it. And I thought that was interesting, because that meant that they knew that South Korea was richer, but they just couldn't say that. And so they were just kind of frozen. But it does seem that a certain amount of reality has actually permeated North Korea.
Yeah, and it goes back to the brainwashing mentality there that you were referencing in the totalitarian state. And, you know, coming from the Soviet Union myself, I recall stories my parents would tell me about, you know, life under a dictatorship and where your fearless leader was, you know, you were to salute him and there were statues and what have you, and there was a certain protocol at work and at school. But at home in the Soviet Union, people knew, listen, okay, it's a farce. They made fun of him. They knew that it was sort of the show that they were forced to put on in the outside world. But at home, a sense of reality set in. I was struck by a Russian director who spent some time in North Korea, film director. And he said he didn't see any of that in North Korea, that what you saw the people do on the streets is what they said and did at home. They truly feel that Kim Jong-un is the mighty leader that can save them and, in you know, some effect, save the world. Is that what you saw?
Well, so North Korea is so tightly controlled that if people have doubts about Kim Jong-un, you would never know it interviewing people in North Korea itself. But I've spent a lot of time interviewing defectors over the years outside the country, and I'm struck that what they say is that the brainwashing essentially works. And that while they themselves, especially after they left North Korea, maybe went to China or to Russia, then they realize that so much of the narrative they'd grown up with was a lie, but that when they were in North Korea, they largely believed it, that their families largely believed it. I think that this is breaking down for people who live in the China border area, because now there's so much trade, people realize that China's better off, it's freer, that the Chinese kind of mock them. But I think away from the Chinese border, I think that the propaganda largely works. And I think that there's probably a reverence as a result for Kim Jong-un that, while it seems to us unimaginable, probably still exists.
For a lot of people in this country, I think their first real focus on North Korea as a totalitarian, dangerous state was in President Bush's Axis of Evil speech. No one seemed to really take North Korea that seriously. It was sort of some rogue nation, and we don't really know much about its leadership, but the focus was more on terrorism in the Middle East and what have you. How did the U.S. drop the ball in with regards to nuclear proliferation or even cyber attacks and their capabilities on that front until recently? I mean, it really does seem to have sped up, even in President Obama's warning to President Trump. I mean, it was like, oh, well, we're 4 or 5, perhaps 6, 7 years away from having this conversation. We're having this conversation 6 months in.
You know, policymakers have been worried about the nuclear issue since the end of the 80s. I remember first hearing that North Korea was working on a bomb in the beginning of 1989. And there, I think two things were going on. One is that there was some expectation that North Korea would collapse and we would be rescued by its collapse. And the other was that we just don't have a good toolbox to affect North Korean behavior. And so it was always easier just to kick the can down the road to adopt President Obama's policy of strategic patience. President Clinton had a policy, an agreement reached in 1994, which was somewhat effective in slowing the North Korean nuclear program, but it essentially involved bribing them, which was kind of distasteful for that reason. And the problem is that, you know, how do you, in retrospect, I think some policymakers think, okay, in 1989, we should have maybe bombed the North Korean nuclear site in Yongbyon, and that would have stopped the nuclear program. Maybe it would have. Of course, it also would have risked a conventional war in the Korean Peninsula, and even a conventional war, one study found, would result in 1 million casualties and $1 trillion worth of damage.
So what is the end game? I mean, it's true that as each new administration comes in, they come in with their own policies, and the Clinton administration now saying that it was, you know, they were willing to talk and negotiate, and they were making some leeway, and then the Bush administration cut off all talks, and, you know, everyone's sort of finger-pointing as to who's to blame here for where things went awry. What do you think the end result will be? Are we going to have to live in a world with a nuclear North Korea? And Jim Clapper, I'm sure you saw last night, said there's about a 25% chance that we could end up in war. That's not trivial.
No, it isn't. And especially that this probably would be a nuclear war. And I would put the odds at about the same rate. So I think a deal is going to be, at this point, really hard to achieve. I went to North Korea partly to try to explore whether a deal might be doable, and I left thinking it probably isn't. So I think that leaves two options. One is a war that would be devastating for the entire globe. One study said that on the very first day of this war, 1 million people would die. I mean, this would be just unimaginable. And the other option, which is very undesirable, is that North Korea continues to develop the capacity to deliver nuclear warheads to the continental U.S., and that we rely on deterrence. And, you know, maybe, I mean, probably this would work. We have been able to deter North Korea from attacking the South for decades. We've deterred them from using chemical and biological weapons for decades. But on the other hand, we didn't deter them from blowing up a South Korean airliner. With nuclear weapons, they might become more aggressive in conventional provocation. So, and of course, you know, at some point, you might get some drunken lieutenant colonel somewhere who decides to push a button.
A miscalculation is what a lot of people fear could actually trigger a war.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there are two scenarios. One is that President Trump, for example, strikes a North Korean ICBM on the launch pad to prevent North Korea from developing the capacity to deliver nuclear weapons to the U.S., and that attacking the missile on the launch pad then triggers a war. And the other scenario is that both sides are on such a hair trigger that there is, as you say, a miscalculation. And, for example, President Trump recently sent B-1 bombers off the North Korean coast. North Korea did not scramble fighter planes to intercept them, but it has said that it will do so the next time. If they were to scramble fighters, one of their fighters were to be shot down, I think that they would respond in some way, in some conventional way, and then I think we would respond. And then it's very hard to stop that escalation in the Korean Peninsula.
I was really struck by Jim Kelly's comments in the White House press briefing room last week, where he said point blank that North Korea is really making improvements in its reentry capabilities as well, and that had sort of been the last frontier hadn't really tackled. Yeah, the last step. The president is expected to travel to Asia in next month. There's debate as to whether or not he should go to the DMZ. Some say yes, it's tradition, it's what past presidents have always done. Others say no, it's just more saber rattling. And again, with this president, you don't know what to expect. What do you think he should do?
So normally I would say that a president should go to the DMZ, as they have done in the past. But actually, I think on balance, I side with those who say no, not this time. And that's partly because I'm nervous about what President Trump might say just extemporaneously in ways that might aggravate tensions, and partly because right now the big problem is that tensions are so high, the last thing we want to do is raise them further. And what we need to try to do is have a little bit of trust building, a little bit of calming of tensions, and a visit to the DMZ by a U.S. president would do the opposite.
Yeah, so we shall see what the president ends up doing there. I want to go and turn to domestic issues here, because there's a war on drugs as well that the president is having to address and deal with. And we as a nation are seeing the fallout from thousands of people dying every year from opioid addiction. There had been, of course, that groundbreaking report from the Washington Post and 60 Minutes that really focused on the distributors and how long this had been going on. And you have a new piece today, Drug Dealers and Lab Coats. You said one of our reasons, and one of the reason our efforts have failed in the war on drugs, and we're talking about illegal drugs like cocaine, is that we ignored the biggest drug pushers of all, the American pharmaceutical companies. Talk about that.
There is an understanding that, the Medellin cartel were about the most evil folks around. But I think what we don't appreciate is that most Americans who end up dying from opioid dependency, they did not get addicted because they started taking heroin. They started now. 75% of Americans with opioid addictions, they started by taking prescription painkillers. And so how did that happen? That happened because in the 1990s, American pharmaceutical companies were looking for new blockbuster drugs to make money. And so they settled on opioids. And to build that market, they very cynically campaigned to convince doctors that pain was being undertreated and that they needed to prescribe more opioid painkillers. And they utterly trivialized the dangers of addiction. They supported front organizations that argued that pain should be the fifth vital sign, that doctors needed to treat it much more aggressively. And this was hugely profitable for the pharmaceutical companies. It made them a ton of money, just as it made a ton of money for the cartels. But it also left this trail of destruction across America, where people start out being prescribed a prescription painkiller for back pain or arthritis or whatever it may be, become addicted, and then at some point they can't get a new prescription. They're desperate. They turn to heroin, and 64,000 Americans died last year of overdoses. 64,000 is more than died in the entire Vietnam and Afghan war combined. And I think that our pharmaceutical companies bear a huge level of responsibility. You know, one company pled guilty to a felony of fraudulent marketing, but no pharma executives have gone to jail.
Yeah, and they've paid just a few million dollars in fine, which is a drop in the bucket.
Compared to the sums that they won. The family that owns the company that indeed pled guilty in that case and that made OxyContin, they 2 years ago, they made the Forbes list of wealthiest families with $14 billion.
And for a president who really understands economic repercussions, I mean, you look at statistics. One economist said that 20% of young white men who are out of the workforce, it's attributed to opioid addiction. I mean, that's just jarring.
That's right. Yeah, half of the people out of the workforce are taking a painkiller every day. Half the men of working age men who are out of the work are taking an opioid every day. And, you know, I think the larger point is that we very much tended to see addiction through the lens of personal weakness and personal irresponsibility. And what I think we've neglected is that there is astonishing corporate greed and irresponsibility that has seized upon individuals in pain and monetized it in ways that have been staggeringly profitable for industry, but have resulted in pain across America.
Real enablers, if you want to use that word. Let's end on a positive note. And in the sense that we live in such a hyper-partisan world and country right now, this, of all issues, I can't imagine not being one that both Republicans and Democrats, obviously their constituents are both equally affected by this. How can we come together as a country in a bipartisan way? What's the first real step that you think we can take in attacking this crisis?
So I think that there is more realism now on both left and right in trying to address opioid addiction, and it's been states like Ohio that have been hardest hit. And I think we're gradually moving toward greater understanding of the problem. I think there's increasing realization that our war on drugs has been a catastrophic failure, that mass incarceration didn't help and broke up families, was enormously expensive and magnified the problem, and an understanding that we need to address this as a public health crisis, not as a criminal justice issue, and that it is a national scandal that only 10% of people with addictions are getting medication-assisted therapy. Portugal has maybe been the country that has most successfully handled an addiction crisis. And they have brought down the number of heroin addicts by 3/4. And they did it by taking this public health focus. I think and hope that we are gradually moving more in that direction toward an evidence-based approach that is based upon a certain amount of compassion as well as evidence that will actually be more effective.
Well, let's hope that this crisis it can now bring the country together in tackling it. Nick Kristof, great to have you on.
Great to be with you.
You know, good luck with your future travels. I like how you said, you know, your wife always discourages you from traveling, and, you know, you don't want the opposite, right, given the countries that you go to?
You know, if your wife is encouraging you to make a trip to North Korea, hey, that's a problem.
Right, red flag. Thanks so much. We appreciate
it. Good to be with you.
And thanks so much for joining us. We want to hear from our listeners, so please send us an email with your thoughts, your feedback, and any suggestions you have at ctmpodcast@cbsnews.com. Thank you for listening. My name is Bianca Golodrigo.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.